Afterward, Sloterdijk in the Question of Aesthetics by Peter Weibel. Introductory remarks. To understand Peter Sloterdijk's writings on aesthetics and why they are unique, it is necessary to give at least an outline of the setting, the historical background to the problems discussed. As we know, art today is a discourse, a conceptual field in which different ideas of pictures, objects, processes, activities, theories, ideas, and institutions all play a role. The instability, contradictions, and conflicts that characterize this field's dynamic make some of its observers and commentators uneasy. Some learn from the example of New Jersey, such as the land artist Robert Smithson, and some from Las Vegas, Robert Venturi, Denise Scott Brown. Some extol autonomous formalism and the sublime, Clement Greenberg. Others, the transfiguration of ordinary things. In his writings on the aesthetic experience, J.M. Bernstein urged us to consider the epistemological, ethical, and political dimension. Aesthetic modernity, he argued, is the adequate and political response to capitalist modernity, which is characterized by rationalization, reification, and disenchantment. True aesthetic modernism should defend radical attitudes against universal and instrumental ambitions using a mixture of Marx, Lukács, Kant, and Adorno. Bernstein enshrined aesthetics in ethics and politics. In the past 20 years, British and American historians and theoreticians of art under pressure from the global media industry have recognized the need to extend analysis of visual culture from the specific objects of art to all forms of image in our culture, to the mass media of film, television, animation, and so forth. The field has widened under the heading of visual culture. W.J.T. Mitchell has emphasized that the visual field is socially constructed, and analogously, the social field is visually constructed. In relation to this pictorial turn, as Mitchell called it, Stanley Cavell and Noel Carroll had already written early on about the mass medium of film as an obvious fact. James Elkins, in his books The Domain of Images, 1999, and Visual Studies, 2003, expanded the theory to include images from natural sciences. Adorno's skeptical work, Aesthetic Theory, 1970, saw art as still having control of the possibility of truth content, but only in a purely utopian function. To do this, art has to reflect society and is thus not completely autonomous. On the other hand, it has to be autonomous to assume a critical function. In terms of a culture industry in which mass culture means tricking the masses, the truth of art can consist of enlightening social illusions. In other words, to undeceive, quoting Batson Brock, and remind people of what society can and should be. Niklas Luhmann described art as a subsystem of the social system that observes itself and is organized according to its own rules. Luhmann was close to Adorno's concept of autonomy. However, as the rules of art, to borrow Pierre Bourdieu's phrase, are a discursive system and therefore open to change, the art system, the operating system of art, is independent of the social context, the institutional situation, and the state of discourse. Peter Weibel and George Dickey stress the independence of art from institutions and its definition and mission, and Arthur C. Danto took up this theme later. Sloterdijk's writings on aesthetics appear in this field of discourse. His studies touch on all the classical and modern branches of the arts, from music to architecture, from the art of enlightenment to the art of movement, from design to typography. He roams across all the fields of the visible and invisible, the audible and inaudible. The historical scope of his observation stretches from antiquity to Hollywood. In other words, he approaches the practice of visual culture at the same time as showing affinities with the institutional theory of art. He reflects on the conditions of present-day art production, from sponsorship to the museum system, from media development to the metamorphoses of aesthetic subjectivity. Likewise, he looks at the classical problems of the philosophy of art, especially its relationship to ethics, epistemology, metaphysics, society, politics, and the subject. from Aristotle to Adorno, and from Kant to Kierkegaard. This raises familiar questions about the status and autonomy of art, its truth content, and its social role. The key in all this is Sloterdijk's inimitable and startling approach, which allows him to stray from the well-trodden paths of art, commentary. Seen through the prism of his thought, art becomes a heterodox form of knowledge. His elaborate use of language and the artistic skill of his changing positions and perspectives reveal unexpected, convincing insights and perceptions. Sloterdijk extends his unique method of discourse estrangement, Diskursverfremdung, to the observation of works and genres of art, and in doing so makes the newly defined objects look completely different. The boundaries between philosophy and literature, argumentation and narration become fluid, and the art objects themselves seem to be set in motion. Under Sloterdijk's scrutiny, familiar aesthetic phenomena become sources of surprise. By giving them a new context, he gives them another existence. The subjects of his theoretical prose appear to the reader like unknown entities. At the same time, they are shown with a kind of detail and familiarity that can only come from a new way of seeing. Sloterdijk's major contribution to the philosophy of aesthetics is that his works provide an important element for solving the problem of modernity. Modernity between disenchantment and re-enchantment. For the past 200 years, the fate of modern art has evolved or expanded between two poles. The two poles are called disenchantment and re-enchantment. Aesthetic agendas of disenchantment and re-enchantment ran through the 20th century in parallel or successively, together and in opposition to each other in sequence or as alternatives, unipolar and bipolar. After Hegel, who saw the world as devastated early on in the period around 1800, Max Weber described the effects of industrialization, the Enlightenment, and the sciences of the 19th century as the disenchantment of the world. The Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution marked the beginning of the epoch of disenchantment, and it would be fine if we call it the epoch of modernity. This is unfortunately impossible because a counter-movement began very early on, a movement that combated the Enlightenment and the end of the absolute in politics and religion, science and its impact and industrialization. This movement aspired to restore the church and the monarchy to their positions of hegemony. Quoting Ernst Cassirer in The Myth of the State, 1946, the German Romanticists were the first heralds in the combat against the philosophy of the Enlightenment. The Romantic era and its commandment, expressed by Novalis, the world must be romanticized, ushered in the agenda of re-enchantment of the world and the arts. The problem is to show that modernity is a combination of the two programs, that the two are interwoven. The French Revolution, 1789 to 1804, signalled the end of absolutism and the beginning of the machine-based industrial revolution. It set the tone and defined the conflicts between the aesthetic, philosophical and political parties and programs of modernity and anti-modernity. The revolution was followed by the Restoration at the Vienna Congress in 1814 to 15. The five great powers, Russia, Austria, Prussia, France and Great Britain, formed a holy alliance. This pledged the crown heads to adopt the Christian religion as the supreme principle for their political acts in order to preserve the divinely ordained feudal structures and to prevent the reforms of the Enlightenment. Between 1816 and 1829, the universities were under surveillance. Censorship was in force and there was restrictions on freedom and teaching, professional bans, special courts and so forth. The years from 1830 to 1848 were once again years of revolution. The first models of parliamentary systems or constitutional monarchies developed with the equal rights for all citizens and freedom of opinion and the press. In 1848, the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels was published. It described the situation of progressive global industrialization as dramatically as if it were talking about globalization nowadays. A long quote here. all fixed, fast frozen relations with their train of ancient land, ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle in everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie has, through its exploitation of the world market, given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. To the great chagrin of reactionists, it has drawn from under the feet of industry the national ground on which it stood. All old established national industries have been destroyed or are daily being destroyed. They are dislodged by new industries whose introduction becomes a life and death question for all civilized nations, by industries that no longer work up indigenous raw material, but raw material drawn from the remotest zones, industries whose products are consumed not only at home but in every quarter of the globe. In place of the old wants satisfied by the productions of the country, we find new wants requiring for their satisfaction the products of distant lands and climes. In place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations. Behind this dialectic of revolution and restoration, of reason and faith, industrialization and idyll, which is discussed in Klaus Lankheit's book Revolution und Restauration, 1965, we can see the movement that reacted to the horror scenarios of the time. Barbaric wars, slums in the cities, pauperism in the countryside. With an agenda of aesthetic re-enchantment that Heinrich Heine called the Romantic School in 1833, Heine was an opponent of the Romantic movement. But what was the Romantic School in Germany? He asked and replied, it was nothing other than the revival of the poetry of the Middle Ages as manifested in the songs, sculpture and architecture, in the art and life of that time. This poetry, however, had had its origins in Christianity. It was a passion flower arising from the blood of Christ. Heine was already operating with the dual contrast of spiritualism and sensuality that was so typical of the contradictions of modernity. He saw sensuality as the school of thought he personally stood for, which defended the natural rights of matter and invoked the Hellenes embodied in Goethe as an honorary Greek. Heine, the poet of the Enlightenment who fought for the end of every form of political and religious absolutism, accused the Romantics of absolute spiritualism and argued that their religiousness led to support for despotism. Referring to the Roman Catholic Church, he argued that the Christian religion, quote, whose unnatural mission actually introduced sin and hypocrisy into the world, became the most reliable form of despotism. People have now recognized the nature of this religion. They will no longer let themselves be fooled by promissory notes on heaven. Just because we now comprehend so completely all the consequences of that absolute spiritualism, we can also believe that the Catholic Christian philosophy of life is doomed. End quote. Well, quite the opposite happened. In fact, the myth returned. F.W.J. Schelling, the leading philosophical writer of the Romantic era, outlined a philosophy of mythology that assigned culture the role of mainspring. Schelling's opinions about art were very important for the art of the German Romantic movement. According to him, the mission of art was to take the highest place among spiritual productions. The task of philosophy, he argued, was to understand the absolute in intellectual contemplation or brilliant intuition. Schelling distinguished between the artificial product and the organic natural product. This allowed him in his oration on the relationship of the formative arts of nature, 1807, to liberate art from the imitation of nature and to proclaim the work of art as a natura naturans that acted in its own accord. This, according to Friedrich Schlegel's concept of universal poetry, fostered the sanctity and purity of art, which implies that caprice is the only law governing the poet. This legacy of the Romantic period was the beginning of the autonomy of art, the sacred axiom of modernity. Schelling's rejection of the imitation of nature inaugurated a turn towards the aesthetics and culture of reception, and paved modernity's ways towards artistic acquisition processes and the emancipation of the viewer. In Schelling's view, the author of the work of art became less important than the work itself and its reception. Quote, "So it is with every true work of art, in that every one of them is capable of being expounded ad infinitum, as if it contained an infinity of purposes, while yet one is never able to say if this infinity has lain within the artist himself or within the work of art." End quote. In other words, infinite exposition ushered in the infinity of interpretation and a culture of the recipient that we find in the 20th century in the works of Mikhail Bakhtin, Walter Benjamin, and Jacques Derrida. Schelling, together with Hegel and Hölderlin, had also considered the reconciliation of aesthetics and philosophy, pleasure and reason, beauty and truth, aesthetics and ethics. Quote, "I am convinced now that the highest act of reason, which embraces all ideas, is an aesthetic act, and that truth and goodness are brothers only in beauty." End quote. He did not allow the reverse conclusion, that beauty only exists as truth and goodness, and that aesthetics is only the brother of politics, ethics, and science. This manifesto shows Schelling and the Romantic movement at the point where the paths divided, at a watershed. Schelling and Hegel went off in different directions. Schelling turned away from reason and knowledge and reverted to faith and mythology. In a lecture series given in 1802 to 1803, later published in the book Philosophy of Art, Schelling wrote, "The unity of the finite and infinite is thus an act in Christianity." The basis of art, he wrote, lay in this new mythology and was closely allied to philosophy as the conceptual representation of the absolute. In this lecture, Schelling established the mythology of Christianity as the founding story of all forms of art. This prescribed the return to Christianity and the philosophy of art around 1800 in an almost dictatorial fashion. By trusting in Christian mythology, by reverting to myth and religion, the Romantic movement followed a pattern of reaction to the disenchantment of the world resulting from industrialization that we are also experiencing today. Many people are seeking refuge in religion again as a reaction to the devastating effects of globalization. The Romantic reaction was radically opposed to the Enlightenment and to German idealism, which was based on the power of rational conceptual thought. To quote the Phenomenology of Spirit, which Hegel wrote in Jena in 1806, "We state the true form of truth to be its scientific character." Hegel outed himself as an opponent to the Romantics, reproaching them. Quote, "The absolute is not to be grasped in conceptual form, but felt, intuited. It is not its conception, but the feeling of it and the intuition of it that are to have the say and find expression." End quote. Hegel was already critical of the Romantic movement's method of visual perception, while Edmund Husserl would later refer to it in his pamphlet Against Rationalism of 1936, "The Crisis of European Sciences and Transcendental Phenomenology, an Introduction to Phenomenological Philosophy." Hegel's introductory lectures on aesthetics, 1835-8, mark the beginning of the final phase of the Romantic form of art. Hegel saw Romanticism as signifying the end of art, as expressed in his famous dictum that philosophy in the shape of self-consciousness of the spirit had replaced religion and was the only thing that could advance towards absolute truth. Religion and art were secondary. Art was defined as the sensual appearance of the idea, giving it an epistemological, conceptual character. Hegel favoured the classical art of the Greeks. He saw the Romantic form of art as evidence of the dissolution of art, in line with his theory that philosophy was the only discipline in which the spirit comes into its own as the highest stage of human development, and the discipline to which sensuality is subordinated. The existence of the central work of art could only be justified as a forum for the human spirit, not as sensuality for itself. In his essay, The End of the Romantic Form of Art, Hegel wrote, a long quote here, Therefore, the artist's attitude to his topic is on the whole much the same as the dramatist's, who brings on the scene and delineates different characters who are strangers to him. The artist does still put his genius into them. He weaves his web out of his own resources, but only out of what is purely universal, or quite accidental there, whereas its more detailed individualization is not his. For this purpose, he needs his supply of pictures, modes of configuration, earlier forms of art which, taken in themselves, are indifferent to him and only become important if they seem to him to be those most suitable for precisely this or that material. It is therefore no help to him to adopt again as that substance, so to say, past worldviews, i.e. to propose to root himself firmly in one of these ways of looking at things, e.g. to turn Roman Catholic, as in recent times many have done for art's sake, in order to give stability to their mind, and to give the character of something absolute to the specifically limited character of their artistic product in itself. End quote. By referring to Romanticism's use of earlier modes of configuration and forms of art, of dramatic staging of pictures that already exist, of eclectic acquisition strategies and indifference, Hegel described Romanticism, as seen from the perspective of the modern age, as a postmodern reaction to the Enlightenment. In fact, we can discern a process of repetition in each epoch. Disenchantment, re-enchantment. Enlightenment versus Romanticism. Modernity versus postmodernity. When the industrial and political revolutions around 1800 ushered in the demise of political absolutism, the concept of the absolute migrated for survival into philosophy and art. There it has survived and has ruled up to the present day. Precisely because modernity never dispensed with its romantic legacy and its challenge to the Enlightenment. The absolute and the spiritual, the religious and the sovereign, the authoritarian and the picturesque still persist in modern art. Spirituality, precisely what Heine reproached the Romantic movement for, survived continuously in the abstract art of the 20th century. This is illustrated by the title of an imposing volume, The Spiritual in Art, Abstract Painting from 1890 to 1985, published 1986, that investigates the influence of Romanticism, mysticism, esotericism and occultism on the genesis and development of abstract art. Another example is Hans Schoigel's book, Das Absolute, 2001, which outlines a panorama of modernity and also contains traces of religious romanticism. A further contribution to the history of ideas of modernity, a book that illustrates the romantic legacy, the quest for the absolute in modern art, is John Golding's Paths to the Absolute, 2000. The contents list already suggests the romantic vocabulary of the fusion of the arts to the level of the sublime. Here are a few examples. Malevich and the Ascent into Ether. Kandinsky and the Sound of Colour. Pollock and the Search for a Symbol. Newman, Rothko, Still, and the Abstract Sublime. The farewell to the absolute never took place. The modern age drowned between Sylla and Charybdis, between enlightenment and idealization, between disenchantment and re-enchantment. In other words, we can say that Romanticism created the aesthetics. In fact, it founded aesthetics as such that helped to form the discourse of modernity, despite all its contradictions and regressions to antiquity, the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, and religion. Romanticism decisively shaped the image of modern art and the modern artist. For example, in the desire to create a new basis for art in the nation and to unite utopia, art, and life. The battle cry of fluxus, of happenings and action art in the 20th century, let's turn our life into a work of art, is literally a demand of Ludwig Tayeck in his book Fantasies on Art for Friends of Arts, 1799. Every sphere of social life was to be aestheticized. They should all become art. This is the echo of Romanticism's program of poeticization. Everything is art, and each person is an artist. What Joseph Beuys proclaimed had already been advocated earlier by Novalis. Every human being should be an artist. Everything can become beautiful art. Friedrich Schlegel's major contributions to Romanticism include his concept of universal poetry. Quote, "There is no realism as true as poetry. Romantic poetry is as progressive, universal poetry. Its mission is not merely to reunite all the different genres of poetry and bring them into contact with philosophy and rhetoric. It seeks, and should seek, to make life and society poetic." End quote. This demand, from the 116th Athenaeum fragment, 1798, brings Schlegel close to Novalis and his program, "The World Must Be Romanticized." Universal poetry itself produces the fusion of the arts, the unification of the genres of poetry and philosophy, see Schelling, the Gesamtkunstwerk that the avant-garde of the 20th century would persistently demand. It is typical of Schlegel, incidentally, that in two Athenaeum fragments he expresses reservations about the outcome of the French Revolution. It is hardly surprising that he converted to the Catholic faith in 1808, and that he and Schlegel became became leading representatives of a form of Christian philosophy. The atheism of the Enlightenment, which established the society based on science and technology and on distribution of knowledge, along with industrialization and political revolutions, marked the beginning of the disenchantment of the world. Romanticism was the first backlash. It was against Enlightenment, reason, science, technology, and industry. It was the first re-enchantment program. There have been repeated movements advocating re-enchantment programs ever since then. There is a long and recurrently fashionable tradition of skepticism in relation to science and technology, the mechanical arts and their results. This skepticism reappeared exactly at the historical moment when the Enlightenment and the Encyclopedia postulated and proclaimed the primary role of science. At that historical moment, under pressure from the dawning Industrial Revolution, rationalization began to embrace every sphere of life, arousing the discontent among some social groups that was famously analysed by Sigmund Freud in Civilization and Its Discontents, 1930. The challenge to this rationalization gave rise to a philosophical tradition that still exists today. As late as 1936, Edmund Husserl, Heidegger's teacher, was still writing about the crisis of European sciences that began with their rationalization. He dated this crisis as far back as Galileo's mathematicization of nature, arguing that the crisis of science consisted of loss of historical experience, which was replaced by mere mathematics. Quote, "Through Galileo's mathematization of nature, nature itself becomes a mathematical manifold," end quote, Husserl wrote. He contrasted intuition and experience with the rationalization of the world more geometrico, by geometrical custom and counterintuitive symbolism, for the actual process of measuring, applied to the intuited data of experience, results, to be sure, only in empirical, inexact magnitudes and their numbers. According to Husserl, the crisis of science is that it is being reduced to mere knowledge of facts because it loses its importance for life. In fact, the crisis of science is also a radical life crisis. Only turning towards history and to the sphere of life could liberate us from this crisis. Husserl, like the Romantics, adjured history as the supreme authority, as the highest source of our actions. The result of the legacy of Romanticism in the modern age is that we have never really become modern, as Bruno Latour has explained. The argument between Enlightenment and absolutism, between concept and intuition, between sensuality and spirituality, and between rationality and religion has obviously not ended. It is continuing under different premises and conditions. This means that the old equations and calculations are no longer valid, and modernity, particularly because of its romantic legacy, has to be superseded. We find suggestions of this in Sloterdijk's writings. Beyond modernity. And the re-enchantment of the world is still attempting today to romanticize, poeticize, and aestheticize life as a whole. It is calling for general aestheticizing, for a return to intuition instead of analysis, to perception instead of abstraction, to pictures instead of numbers. Walter Benjamin observed the two positions and presented them brilliantly in the conclusion of his essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, written in German in 1935-36. This is the situation of politics which fascism is rendering aesthetic. Communism responds by politicizing art. Benjamin continued, but the instant the criterion of authenticity ceases to be applied to artistic production, the total function of art is reversed. Instead of being based on ritual, it begins to be based on another practice, politics. The logical result of fascism is the introduction of aesthetics into political life. All efforts to render politics aesthetic culminate in one thing: war. Fascism took refuge in an aestheticization of politics, and communism in a politicization of aesthetics. This leads to the conclusion that total aestheticization includes politics, and thus that romanticism ends in fascism, whereas total politicization of aesthetics impels Hegelianism into Marxism. These, then, are the two poles between which the fate of modernity played out: the disenchantment program and the re-enchantment program. There has long been a yearning for an agenda that frees us from this dilemma, even if the price is the end of modernity. Sloterdijk's philosophical aesthetics offers basic elements and methods for retreating or departing from modernity. This crucially involves creating a new context and definition for aesthetic judgment, aesthetic value, and aesthetic experience, which were all classically defined in a generally binding form modelled on Kant's categorical imperative. Imperare is the Latin word for to order or to decree. The imperative is a type of order, a commandment, a law. Kant's categorical imperative is a general commandment for practical action in the sphere of ethics. It says, quote, for a human being can never be treated merely as a means to the purposes of another. The categorical imperative can be seen as a practical law similar to the laws of nature. So act that the maxim of your action can become a universal law, end quote. Get out of here, Wecker. The categorical imperative is a law of reason, a basic law of practical reason. The philosophy of aesthetics. The philosophy of aesthetics has assumed so far that the same rational conditions also apply to the aesthetic experience, and that... Wait. Bird trying to eat my headphones. What was I saying? The philosophy of aesthetics has assumed so far that the same rational conditions also apply to the aesthetic experience, and that aesthetic knowledge obeys universal laws, that aesthetics is not just a subjective field, because only taste is a matter for argument, whereas aesthetic judgments follow universally valid and binding rules and laws. Sloterdijk's writings show that an aesthetic imperative of this kind, that acts secretly in some ways as a precondition for all existing aesthetics, cannot possibly exist. And in doing so, he turns modernity upside down. Ovid's Dictum from Daedalus and Icarus, the eighth book of his Metamorphoses, et ignotas animum dimittit in artes, and he turned his mind to unknown arts, can be rendered as, and he turned his mind to the arts in an unknown way, to escape the fate of modernity. Sloterdijk's aesthetic project has an ethical dimension. This is the question that echoes in Kant's famous phrase, the starry heavens above me, and the moral law within me. The connection between aesthetics and ethics, what can connect aesthetic pleasure, which is uniquely defined by the experience and appearance of beauty, and which is at the centre of what we describe as epiphany, with the ethical law of Kant's categorical imperative? How can the one thing be the echo of the other? How can Alexander Gottlieb Baumgarten's Aesthetica from 1751 be related to Kant's ethics and Hegel's philosophy? How can we describe an aesthetic experience without spoiling our enjoyment? How can we make it harmonize with philosophy at the same time? Are truth and beauty related? Is truth only a product of the intellect and beauty only a product of the senses? Isn't it possible for the intelligible to be an event and result of the senses, and beauty a product of the intellect, and therefore truth? Did the equations truth equals beauty and beauty equals truth lose their meaning in the 20th century, the nightmare of history? Is the assertion that the world has become absurd and meaningless the same as the assertion that art has become ugly as well? Aren't cognition processes the precondition for enjoying beauty? And isn't it really itself? And isn't it reality itself that produces the enjoyment in the first place? Does aesthetic enjoyment exist beyond the pleasure principle? Or in other words, has aesthetic pleasure been extracted from the pleasure principle and squeezed out of it by sublimation and asceticism? If Jacques Lacan accused Freud of political agnosticism in his lecture on science and truth, La science et la vérité, 1965, one could accuse Sloterdijk of aesthetic agnosticism because he thinks sublimation does not produce beauty, but on the contrary, beauty and aesthetic enjoyment are to be found beyond the pleasure principle. There is a limitation, however. The place where the enjoyment occurs is not necessarily the desirable place for other people. In this respect, we are talking about a limitation of Kant's categorical imperative. Sloterdijk is not demanding a universal ethics that would apply to each individual and therefore to history. It is the attempt to escape from seeing the nightmare of history as the meaning. But can the aesthetic replace the meaning in the same way as repetition can replace sublimation? Meaning and senses, conceptions and perceptions, knowledge and beauty form a new equation in Sloterdijk's treatment. An equation that does not serve either Thanatos or Eros, but on the contrary tries to escape from both of them. Sloterdijk's aesthetics is not, however, a theory of compensation, because it does not separate from the idea that aesthetic enjoyment has to remain at the heart of the aesthetic experience. Writers do not separate from life through their writing, and artists do not separate from life through their work, and consequently transmit the death wish. On the contrary, writing and the work of art, or reading as such, are the enjoyment and the celebratory act of life. This is how aesthetic experience can be harmonized with enjoyment, reconciling the pleasure principle and the reality principle. Sloterdijk goes from the categorical imperative to a law of desire located between Kant, Freud, and Lacan. He does not see culture as the sublimation of libidinous desire, just as Aristotle did not regard the concept of philia in the Nicomachean Ethics as utility or lust or virtue. Precisely because he rejects a universal application of aesthetics, there is no universal application of ethics. Ethical and aesthetic commands should not be robbed of their absurd character or their imperative character. Sloterdijk follows the ideas of Blaise Pascal expressed in his Thoughts on Religion. Quote, "All men naturally hate themselves. We take advantage, as we can, of concupiscence? You heard that word, concupiscence, to promote the public good, but it is only a pretense. In a word, selfishness has two qualities. It is essentially unjust because it aims to become the centre of everything, and it is offensive to others because it would make them its slaves. For everyone in whom self is a leading principle is the enemy and would be a tyrant of the human race." Even before Kant proposed his categorical imperative, Pascal had relativized it. The logic of the categorical imperative does not function in any situation where people all hate and serve, exploit and subjugate each other. Pascal's solution, as we know, is faith. Credo quia absurdum. I believe because it is absurd. Sloterdijk takes a similar approach. He shows the aggressiveness of any imperative, whether the ethical or the aesthetic. Kant tried to turn the command of the Gospels, love your neighbour as you do yourself, into a rational call. It is in this way, no doubt, that we are to understand the passages from Scripture that contain the command to love one's neighbour, even our enemy, since love out of inclination cannot be forbidden, but beneficence from duty itself is practical and not pathological love, and only the former can be commanded. Well, this command, as we know, is the categorical imperative, which is based solely on the logic of the rational demand for freedom from contradiction, and which tells every rational being to respect the human being and the other person. Kant wanted us to separate the commandment to love as an ethical imperative from religious faith and to explain it rationally. This practical ethics corresponded to a practical aesthetics. Aesthetics went through exactly the same process in the 19th century when it tried to establish itself as a science. It was the experience of detaching beauty from faith, in other words, from the intuition of visual perception, emotion, and so forth, and explaining it rationally. The aesthetic experience, the emotional impact of beauty, gave rise to a rational call, a commandment, a demand that sounded almost legal. Aesthetics became part of jurisdiction to some extent. It was interpreted according to the commandments of the aesthetic gospel. The aesthetic experience became a commandment and a law, which robbed it of meaning because aesthetics were actually supposed to be the field of pathological love, the field of mere inclination. Taste, as we know, is a matter of argument, and that is the essence of taste. It is negotiable, something to barter with, and not a law. When aesthetic starts commanding, it becomes impossible to enjoy it. Commands spoil aesthetic pleasure because the point of aesthetic pleasure is to act without orders and commandments and laws. Crossing the line, transgression, is consequently a crucial moment of future aesthetics. Sloterdijk attacks the aesthetic command, the dictates of the beautiful. He knows that the destiny of culture's progress lies buried between ethical and aesthetic orders and commandments. The human tendency towards aggression that Pascal identified does not contribute to culture by resisting progress, as Kant and Freud believed. As Freud wrote in Civilization and Its Discontents, culture's moral claim to oppose aggressiveness, which it makes through the commandment to love one's neighbour, actually reinforces it. It is a paradox that anything that opposes aggressiveness decisively strengthens this aggressiveness. In other words, aesthetic commandments do not work to eliminate barbarism. The aesthetic imperative that we counterpose to barbarism actually reinforces the latter. Anything that opposes ugliness paradoxically acts as the decisive factor in reinforcing it. Anyone who outlines an ethics of eros, of eroticism, paradoxically contributes to the aesthetics of thanatos, the death instinct. The Nazi aesthetics of Leni Riefenstahl shows us how the aesthetics of the death instinct and of aggression cloaked in ethics of aggression. At some point, we realize that if ethics is the field of eros, the commandment to love one's neighbor, aesthetics, is the field of thanatos, the commandment of the death instinct. Sloterdijk wants to liberate us from the dilemma of a 200-year-old alliance of ethics and aesthetics, from categorical and aesthetic imperatives. He refers to Nietzsche's ideas as expressed by Zarathustra. One should honour even the enemy in one's friend. Can you step up close to your friend without going over to him? In one's friend, one shall have one's best enemy. You should be closest to him in your heart when you strive against him. These quotes show the reversal of the commandment to love and the appeal to Pascal's definition of the ego as the enemy of every ego. Nietzsche did not say, love your neighbour to the extent that you love your enemy as a friend. He famously reversed the values and said that one's friend should be one's best enemy, and one should even honour the enemy in one's friend. This rule would wipe out once and for all the ideas that we can use enemy images, because the only available images we would have would be those of our friends. The equation, as we construe it, between hell is other people, according to Jean-Paul Sartre, and the idea that we ourselves are the only good ones, the kind of thinking the politics of the United States has always specialized in, and still does today, this infernal equation is in fact the universal quality of the commandment to love. Freud saw the commandment to love one's neighbor as nearly inhuman, or at least that was what Lacan wrote in his book, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis. 1959 to 60. Paradoxically, we escape from this infernal equation if we abandon the universal nature of the commandment to love. In other words, if we abandon the ethical and aesthetic imperatives and admit that these imperatives have a mutual affinity, we must abandon the universality of the aesthetic commandments to really allow ourselves to act aesthetically and to extricate ourselves from the aesthetic hell of the modern age. So we could say that Sloterdijk has designed an ethics of aesthetics in which aesthetic imperatives do not appear. He sees the aesthetics of modernism as inhuman and is looking for a human aesthetics. In this respect, he is following Lacan, who taught us that everything that can be transformed from enjoyment to commandment or prohibition simply reinforces the prohibition all the more. We can see that this commandment orders the subject enjoy and shows him his own castration in a horrifying manner through this commandment. The command enjoy castrates the subject and spoils the pleasure. Aesthetic pleasure can only function if it does not have to obey any commandment or prohibition. For this reason, Sloterdijk opposes an aesthetic imperative derived from Kant and his categorical imperative. There should be no restrictions on aesthetic enjoyment because they inspire resistance, and this resistance spoils the pleasure. The commandment to love contains the possibility of inhumanity, and Kant's categorical imperative also contains the possibility of inhumanity. And that is why Sloterdijk denies the possibility of an aesthetic imperative. He also rejects Nietzsche's solution of turning the expression of the aggressive instinct into an expression of the will to power, which Foucault attempted to use in his analysis of power in the Western system. Sloterdijk's aesthetic blueprint does not represent any particular collective teaching, and he does not even see aesthetic experience inspiring the creation of a cultural collective, because he knows this could be used as a basis for a political regime. Every imperative reminds a person of his or her isolation, the compulsion of a commandment from the superego. Sloterdijk demands a democracy that allows subjectivities to shift their conflicts by not formulating them absolutely clearly. This is the meaning of his literary and philosophical methods of de-definition, or undefinition. Taking Pascal's insight and Nietzsche's error, he looks for the basis for a subjectivity that is neither power nor tyranny, but the foundation for an aesthetics of democratic subjectivity. Here too we can refer to Hegel and his basic principles of the philosophy of right, which already provide us with the idea of a paradoxical link between the rhetoric of desires, aesthetics, and the logic of the political, ethics, because Hegel evolved a system of right based on special qualities and uniqueness and not on universal liability. By the same token, Sloterdijk's aesthetics is a theory of singularity and not a universal construction.